United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Robert M. Davis presiding. All about business before this court drawn near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. I'm Judge Davis. To my right is Judge Peach, and to my left is Judge Greenberg. Before we start the Rosinsky matter, I'd like to make an announcement regarding procedure today. We do have a very special occasion. We are presenting an award to the Pro Bono Consortium immediately following the Rosinsky argument. And we will basically take a 15-minute recess after the court greets counsel at the bench after the oral argument. My colleagues who will be here will join me in the roving room, and we will come back out and conduct the pro bono presentation. So I just want those of you all who are here, you're certainly welcome to stay for the argument. But we will need to clear the courtroom immediately after the argument in order to prepare for the ceremonial session. And then you're welcome to come back. And perhaps most importantly, there will be refreshments served at the conclusion of the ceremonial session. So I just wanted to make that point. We're here today on the matter of Rosinsky against Shulkin, docket number 17-1117. Will the parties for the counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record?
Walton McLeod, Your Honor, here for the appellate, Mr. Rosinsky.
Welcome.
Mark Vichich for the secretary. With me at counsel's table is Richard Daly, Deputy Chief Counsel of the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Welcome. Thank you all. The case concerns whether the VA should provide attorneys who represent claimants during regional office proceedings with access to draft rating decisions. And we also have amicus argument as well. Ms. Drake, could you stand and identify yourself, please?
Good morning. Thank you. I'm here on behalf of the National Law School Veterans Clinic Consortium, and my name is Angela Drake. I teach at the University of Missouri School of Law.
Thank you. Welcome here. Each party will have, we've extended the time given the significance of this case for oral argument. Each party will have 45 minutes to present your respective arguments. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 10 minutes.
10 minutes, we'll so note it. Amicus will have 5 minutes after the main argument from the appellant. And I would like to proceed basically in this order, and we'll try to keep it as streamlined as possible. But first, we would like to ask questions and engage counsel regarding whether the court has jurisdiction to consider the issue. Second, whether Mr. Rosinsky has standing to raise this issue. Third, whether the VA must provide an attorney with access to a draft rating decision in the same manner as it provides access to veteran service organizations. And fourth, whether the court should certify for aggregate action a class consisting of similarly situated attorneys practicing before the VA. And we will try to move those issues forward in the context of your time allotted. Does anyone need me to repeat those? Okay, great. Having said that, I think we are ready to proceed. Mr. McLeod?
May it please the court. In Freeman, This court stated that the driving principle that led Congress to create this court was a desire to ensure fair adjudication of veterans' claims. The Secretary's policy denies fairness, both to attorneys and the claimants they represent. Tradition is not a basis for a prejudicial policy, especially when that policy impedes the rights of equal access and process. First, today we are seeking equal access for Mr. Rozinski and all other attorneys similarly situated to his client's information. Second, we are seeking equal process for Mr. Rozinski's clients and all other similarly situated claimants. And we are asking this court to do so in an aggregate fashion through aggregate action order. This court has jurisdiction to hear this case because Mr. Rozinski satisfies all the elements of the All Writs Act. And a petition is appropriate because there's no alternative means available. This matter was initiated 3.5 years ago through communications from Mr. Rozinski to the Secretary, no less than 8 separate times of written communications. To date, there has not been the Secretary has still not granted his request for access. At 3.5 years, it would be futile to expect the Secretary to reverse himself at this court at this point. So there's no other alternative remedy, which is similar to what this court dealt with in Rubato. Further, Mr. Rozinski has a right to the writ, an indisputable right to the writ, because it affects his ability to practice, affects his ability to provide competent representation, which is required by the Secretary, and both through congressional statute and through the Secretary's regulations and their standards of conduct.
May I interrupt just for a minute? Well, apart from the All Writs Act, don't we have jurisdiction to hear the complaint by Mr. Rozinski?
Yes, Your Honor.
As a constitutional court?
I believe you have jurisdiction to hear this matter, Your Honor, through 5904. This is obviously a matter that affects the provision of benefits. The other issues before you would be the right to representation, the right for a veteran or his client or similarly situated veterans for representation at each stage of the claims process through 3103. And also the court has authority here through 7261 to set aside such prejudicial policies that are arbitrary and capricious.
Counsel, are there any other statutory provisions you might cite to for jurisdictional purposes?
Well, Your Honor, I would, in addition, in our brief, I would note that the claims process has already been provided for statutorily. From claims being filed through 501 and 3115 to notice of disagreement through section 7105 to appeals to the board through 7266. To the extent that the Secretary's policy has created an extra stage to the claims process, it runs afoul of what the Congress has already established for the claims process. I believe this court has jurisdiction and authority to act to the extent that policy is violative of that clear congressional intent and statutory intent.
Well, wouldn't we also have jurisdiction pursuant to the statement made by Justice Alito in Henderson that we are acting as if we were an Article III court reviewing the actions of an administrative agency?
I would agree, Your Honor, and to your point, I believe under the AWA, this court has authority to act to reach the rational ends of law.
So might I just add a couple of other statutory provisions for your consideration, counsel? Section 511, Section 5104, and Section 5701. I think some of those were discussed in your brief as well.
Thank you, Your Honor. And to the extent that I leave any of those out, I would certainly stand the
recommendation. Don't get us wrong. We're not excluding something just because you failed to mention it in oral argument. We've read your briefs and we understand your position. That's correct, isn't it?
Continuing on, Your Honor, as far as the court asked for some language on standing, our client, Mr. Rosinski, has standing here because he suffers both a professional and an economic harm as a result of the policy. From a professional standpoint, Your Honor, Mr. Rosinski and all other attorneys who represent veterans are required to provide competent representation. And from 5904 and from the regulations in 14632, that requires a diligence, preparedness, knowing the issues of law, and providing prompt representation. To the extent that Mr. Rosinski and other attorneys are denied access that is provided to other VSO claims representatives, prevents an attorney like Mr. Rosinski from doing his job with the most zealous advocacy that he's required to give. And as far as an economic harm, Your Honor, any attorney who can't provide competent representation as a result of this policy, it also has an inherent effect on their ability to reach the result, and usually from that result will result in some sort of fee. So there's a clear economic harm that results from the denial of the access that prevents the competent representation that is required by statute and by regulation.
Mr. McLeod, let's talk a little bit about the details of the standing requirement. The Supreme Court in 1992 kind of laid out the general Article III standing requirements. First, the plaintiff must have suffered injury in fact. Second, there must be a causal connection between the injury and the conduct complained of. And third, it must be likely, as opposed to speculative, that the injury will be redressed by a favorable decision. What exactly is Mr. Rosinski's interest here, and what exactly is the economic harm?
If I understand your question correctly, the injury, in fact, here would be twofold. The policy injures his ability to provide the type of representation he's required to give. An attorney who doesn't have access to his client's file in a manner that other claims representatives do, that is an impediment to his ability to his duty to provide competent representation. As to the injury, in fact, from the economic standpoint, goes in line with if you can't provide that competent representation, if you miss the opportunity to provide that advocacy tool that attorneys are denied, you miss the advocacy opportunity to correct mistakes. And as we noted in our brief in one of our footnotes, this is a real thing that's happened. Mr. Rosinski's had a situation where one of his clients was forced to appeal a decision that had an error on the year, just a clerical error essentially, but with major results or adverse effects for his client and for himself because it denied, it delayed the result that needed to be reached, and it also created an economic harm also for his client and resulting in a larger fee later down the road. If that answers your question,
The N21 provides for a vehicle for correcting mistakes that is short of appealing, and you know, reviewing a draft rating decision, which is not final, is something that is part of the special relationship that the Veterans Service Organizations have with the department in the non-adversarial system. So I'm trying to really get a handle on how Mr. Rosinski has been harmed financially. Has he lost clients? Has someone complained that because he wasn't given the opportunity to review a draft rating decision, they are no longer going to have him represent them, but they will seek representation from the American Legion or the DAV, or, I mean, where is the economic harm here?
Well, Your Honor, I believe the economic harm results in by denying the access and the process for his clients, the inevitable result is the delay and the loss of the ability to secure fees.
Well,
in part.
But what about the, why are we talking about necessarily the economic harm to the lawyer? I mean, isn't there potential for unequal treatment by reason of this practice to the veteran?
Yes, Your Honor.
He's representing a veteran. This is not a mere money-getting trade that we're talking about, right?
And it's not. It's certainly not all about it. It's really, we talked about a special relationship between the VSO and the VA. The most special relationship is between the VA and the veteran, who's the ultimate person that we're all trying to work for. So to the extent that Mr. Rosinski's access is denied, it invariably has an effect on the veterans he represents, and for that matter, each attorney in the country that represents veterans in the system that has that access denied, their clients suffer a consequence.
May I ask this question regarding Mr. Rosinski's, the background that led to this? Did Mr. Rosinski request the draft the RO's decision on behalf of a particular client?
I would have to look in the brief. That was an exhibit to our brief. There were eight different.
And in the exhibit, he talked about the example you brought up.
To be clear, Your Honor, the first communication with the VA was on behalf of the client.
And at that
and
point.
That's what initiated the process.
Okay, and at that point, when Mr. Rosinski requested that draft decision on behalf of a particular client, why did not Mr. Rosinski initiate the action that's now before the court with the client in mind? But now it's Mr. Rosinski that's petitioning, not the client, not the veteran or the claimant.
Well, I think Mr. Rosinski gave the Secretary the opportunity, in my opinion, to do the right thing. And ultimately, we've reached the point of futility where that's why we're here. Because, I mean, the process was initiated on behalf of his client, and it continued through.
But why isn't the client the petitioner, then?
I think the client could be a petitioner, but so could Mr. Rosinski. I don't think they are exclusive. I think an attorney represents the client. Anything that affects the attorney affects the client. Anything that affects the client is, therefore, also connected to the attorney. So I think a veteran could bring this petition just as well as a attorney, but they're not exclusive of one another.
Well, what about, were you? No. Well, what about drawing an analogy long settled, I think, to associations, labor organizations, labor unions representing their membership? You don't need an individual member of the union, do you, to have standing to bring an action on behalf of the members of the union?
That is my understanding, Your Honor.
You don't need an individual necessarily to bring an action on behalf of someone aggrieved by a violation of their civil rights if an organization brings such an action. Isn't the case law replete with determinations by the Supreme Court on that issue?
I believe that is my understanding, Your Honor.
Counsel, are you familiar with the Supreme Court decision in Kowalski, a 2004 decision that discusses third-party standing? No?
To the extent that it was briefed, but standing here, I can't tell you exactly what the case stands for, Your Honor.
Well, the case is closely analogous to this case because you had an attorney who was attempting to represent indigent clients in Michigan, and the court held that the attorney lacked third-party standing to assert the rights of Michigan indigent defendants who were denied appellate counsel based on plea agreements. I was just wondering if that had any relevance to this situation from your standpoint.
If I understand your question correctly, Your Honor, we're not seeking third-party standing.
Mm-hmm.
We believe Mr. Rosinski has standing on his own footing.
Mm-hmm.
And if I could just make sure I try to answer all of your questions regarding his standing, one of the issues you brought up was the repetition. And this has the capability of being repeated with Mr. Rosinski every time he has a claimant, every time he represents a veteran, and this policy is in effect, and all other attorneys as well.
Okay.
Well, what's the explanation for this? What did the Secretary tell Mr. Rosinski was the reason for this disparity between a lawyer representing an individual client, a veteran? This is not an abstraction, right? He had a client on which he made this request. He was denied the same access to the documentation that veteran service organizations apparently have.
Your Honor, the only basis...
What do they say?
Your Honor, the only basis we've received was tradition, that the Secretary has traditionally allowed access to VSOs in this manner, and at this time, they're not going to be able to, they're not granting that same access to attorneys.
Thank you.
Well, that kind of moves us into the third area, actually. It's a nice segue, Judge Greenberg. Whether the VA must provide an attorney with access to the draft rating decisions in the same manner it provides VSOs. And by the way, I meant to compliment both sides and the amicus as well regarding the very well-written briefs in this matter. So I meant to do that earlier, but I want to let you all know that it was a pleasure to read all of the briefs. But let's talk about the third issue then. Mr. McLeod, isn't there a really big difference between the attorneys in this field and the veteran service organizations? I mean, aren't the veteran service organizations partners in an informal process? They have, in fact, offices at the VA around the country. There's been a historic partnership in resolving issues for veterans, and doesn't that certainly make them not similarly situated to attorneys?
Your Honor, the fact that VSOs have offices in the VA may be true, but the Secretary's policies also provide in the M21 that the relationship between claims representatives and the VA is one of equal partnership, and that, you know, that includes all claims representatives. So it doesn't add up for an equal partnership to then two pages over be severed by a policy that denies access to one group of claims representatives in this stance, in this case attorneys like Mr. Rosinski.
Is there a problem with if the attorney had access, the attorney would be duty bound to share that information with the client? That's not the case with VSOs.
The attorney has to follow the standards of conduct that he's that are statutorily put out in 5904 and regulation standards of conduct.
Right.
I think with the draft ratings decision, the most important issue here is the process itself. The entire claims process is statutorily provided for. Now, what the Secretary is doing here with this policy is he's creating a new stage in the claims process, which we're not arguing. He can create stages. That's not the issue. The issue is he's denying an entire group of claims reps and their veteran claimants access to the same process. It's one thing to have a policy that has value. There's clear value in the process of allowing a VSO to look at a draft rating decision, to have the opportunity to correct errors before a decision is promulgated. But the value is lost when it's denied to an entire group of people, particularly attorneys like Mr. Rosinski and the clients they represent. So, to the extent that the Secretary's additional stage that's not statutorily provided for is part of the claims process, and to the extent that it is the access for attorneys and process for their clients' claimants is denied, that runs afoul of all notions of fundamental fairness.
Well, let me ask you this. You're not seeking to dilute or change the access of the VSOs to this process. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Whether it's traditional or custom, by the way, it's not part of any regulatory scheme. They didn't adopt a regulation, did they? The VA saying VSOs are going to have access, but lawyers aren't? It's just a matter of custom.
And their policy.
Right. So what you want is equal access for lawyers along with VSOs. You don't want to change the current status of the VSOs to access.
No, Your Honor, that's not what we're seeking.
That's right. So, and I may be a little simplistic in the graphic, but as I understand it, there's literally a table in the regional office where these proposed rating decisions are put there for the VSO to examine for correctness or any mistakes and so forth. So, conceptually, the lawyer should have the same ability to come in, either actually or by electronic means, however it's done, as a VSO representative. Is that what you're seeking?
Yes, Your Honor.
Anything more than that?
Well,
and whatever the lawyer, if I may add, whatever the lawyer's obligation to his client is between the lawyer and his client. Would you agree with that proposition?
Yes, Your Honor.
So all you're seeking is equal access to the same information that VSOs get.
That's
on
correct.
Behalf of lawyers, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
To the extent that you know, does anybody else, can anybody else besides VSO access those draft decisions, say a claimant who's not represented by a VSO but comes in on his own, or sometimes spouses help out, family members help out, are they authorized access?
Well, Your Honor, I understand that the policy provides for VSO access. So as an attorney's access is denied, it's a pro se would also not have the VSO access if they were not represented by a VSO.
Mr. McLeod, is it your understanding that the purpose behind the policy is to allow the VSOs to make corrections to a proposed draft rating decision?
That's correct, Your Honor. Clerical errors, and the policy was changed most recently in July, I believe,
right.
Which provided
right.
actually the opportunity for VSOs and the decision maker to have conversations, substantial discussions, mm-hmm. which in reality makes the problem worse.
But that's before the rating decision is issued. Right.
The process is before the rating yes. decision is issued. Yes.
So, is there another way for an attorney to address a problem in a rating decision that is issued? Is there a way to correct any errors in the rating decision, to your knowledge?
After it's been promulgated,
yes,
and a final decision, then it has to be appealed in the normal course.
Is that the only way? And doesn't M21 provide for and allow for corrections after the decision is issued?
It's our understanding from practice that a decision must be appealed after it's been promulgated.
Let me share with you the fact that, in fact, there is a way based on the M21 to correct errors in an issued rating decision, and that's in the material. It's in the M21. Short of an appeal. So I guess my point is that may not be the only way to correct a rating decision is through appeal. That's all.
And if I could just add briefly, Your Honor, I believe in our brief in a footnote, that situation was addressed for Mr. Rosinski in the, I'll call it the post-decision correction request was refused.
Okay.
Would you consider that the requirement that the VSOs can have access, do you consider that a policy of the VA?
Well, it's in the M21, so I would consider that a policy.
Wouldn't it be inappropriate for this court to interfere with that?
I'm sorry?
Wouldn't it be inappropriate for this court to interfere?
Your Honor, this court has authority to set aside findings, conclusions of the Secretary that are arbitrary and capricious, not in accordance with the law. So I would submit that this court has authority to act to remedy the prejudicial nature of this policy.
Just to emphasize that point, this policy has never been adopted in accordance with the Administrative Procedure Act as a regulation, has it?
No, Your Honor, there's no rule.
Has the M21, this manual, by the way, this manual is for the internal use of employees of the department, is it not, in adjudicating claims?
Yes, Your Honor.
So it could be changed, it could be modified by the Secretary at any time, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. And it's this document, the M21, doesn't allow lawyers access on the same basis as the VSOs. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
All right.
So, Mr. McLeod, is there, in your view, Is there any basis for distinguishing veteran service officer representatives from attorneys for the purposes of access to the draft rating decision?
No, Your Honor. VSOs and attorneys are both claims representatives, accredited, recognized by the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, with the same duties and standards of conduct in 5904 and 14632 to do a job and advocate for their client.
To your knowledge, is there a statutory right that confers to any person the right to review a draft rating decision?
Apart from the broad duty to assist statute.
Your Honor, the only thing I would add is, you know, as far as 3103E, you know, states that veterans are entitled to the representation of their choice at every stage of the claims process, and to the extent the Secretary uses an additional stage for only some claims representatives, is a statutory violation.
Well, part of the argument, as I understand it, is that there's a fair process or a due process concern here as well, and under constitutional due process analysis, there has to be a property interest, right?
Well,
so my question is really fairly specific regarding whether or not you know of a statute that has created a property interest in the right to review a draft policy.
The only constitutional the constitutional implication here, I think, is best addressed from Cushman, which stated that a fundamentally fair adjudication process was constitutionally required in all cases.
Okay. Good. Great. You may summarize if you like, counsel.
In conclusion, Your Honor, this court has jurisdiction to hear this properly submitted petition and order equal access for Mr. Rosinski and all other similarly situated attorneys, as well as order equal process for his clients and other situated claimants. We ask this court for an aggregate order to ensure that equal access and process is granted for attorneys and the claimants they represent. In addition, we would also ask this court for reasonable attorney's fees and costs subject to EJA.
Let me ask this question. Has any other attorney approached you or Mr. Rosinski to be included in your request for class action?
I would answer that, Your Honor. I believe attorneys are keenly aware of this case, but as far as and I maybe someone else will speak to that as well, but as far as a request to be part of class, not in a formal.
Well, let me ask you this. Oh, sorry. Judge Beach, had you finished your... Yeah. When you say that Mr. Rosinski is an adequate representative of the class of, by reason of his background, training, and experience, an adequate representative of the class of lawyers that he seeks to represent in the aggregate here? The answer better be yes.
Yes. I wasn't sure if you were finished, Your Honor.
Yes.
At the record note, that was an emphatic yes. Mr. McLeod, is there a reason why a panel decision emanating from this court would not set the rule such that it wouldn't be necessary to certify a class? If this panel said, make the VSO draft, make the draft rating decisions available to attorneys, wouldn't that answer the question?
I would respond, Your Honor, that a class action, an aggregate order would solve the problem in a more efficient manner. I think we believe that the facts of this case are really tailor-made for this court to exercise aggregate authority, in avoiding any sort of pitfalls that would come with a precedential decision.
Okay. Very good. Anything else? Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank Powell. You. I've reserved my time.
Ms. Drake?
Thank you. May it please the court. Again, I'm here on behalf of the National Law School Veterans Clinic Consortium. We are a group of clinical directors. We help law students help veterans with their disability claims. We are accredited attorneys. All right. The Office of General Counsel has taken our paperwork and given us a number and told us that we can represent claimants. And we are keenly interested in securing access to completed rating decisions, which is what the manual calls these things, because we want to help our veterans as soon as possible. I teach my students that we want to make the best record possible as early as possible. And why is that? I believe the government attached their life cycle document to their brief. We attached it to ours. This is a Department of Veterans Affairs document. This describes the appeals process that happens after a rating decision is promulgated, which has error in it. It is a very long process. It is very complicated. The Government Accounting Office recently did a report showing that on average it's a 5-year delay for veterans. Again, we are keenly interested in preventing substantial delay, and we want to make the best record possible as early as possible. So if we, as the accredited representative, we've been empowered to represent these claimants. If we can see a rating decision that has a wrong effective date because somebody didn't know there was an intent to file, or if we can see a rating decision that omits the medical opinion that we submitted, and we can rectify that error early in the process, that is so much better for the veteran.
Counsel, have you requested to see a draft rating decision and been denied?
I have not had the opportunity to. I'm still waiting on my VBMS access.
Have any clinics, to your knowledge, requested the privilege to review a draft rating decision have been denied?
And, well, not that I'm aware of. I will say that Elena Duterte with Syracuse, who is on the brief, has actually reviewed a completed rating decision in draft form. And she was allowed to do so by the regional office. She has VBMS access. Since the filing of the brief, I have heard from one other clinical director that they have seen it pop up on their screen that they can review it. So to the extent the secretary has told the court in the briefing that attorneys can never have access, that's simply not true.
That's in the capacity of nonprofit clinics that are representing veterans. Is that more akin to a veteran service organization than a standalone attorney?
Well, I don't know. We're all accredited representatives. The statute allows us to represent the claimant. The regulation 3.103 allows the veteran to have the representative of their choice, So they can have me for free. They can enter into a fee arrangement with an attorney if they want, which may be a very good thing. That attorney may be willing to go get them a very expensive medical opinion. That may be a great thing for the veteran. Or the veteran may want to go to the American Legion. The regulation and the statute, which gives rise to it, tells the veteran, you pick. And then the regulation says, in 3.103, procedural due process, once you pick your representative, that representative you get at every stage, And here I am as an attorney trying to help law students who are also empowered under the regulation to help veterans, which is wonderful. We're cut out of a really, really significant part of the prosecution of a claim where we could correct an error and save a veteran 5 years. For that reason alone, I think the Secretary's rule must be set aside.
So if you had asked for access to the draft rating decision in your capacity of representing a client in your clinic, and you were denied access or you didn't get access, what would you do?
Well, I would like to join in Mr. Rosinski's class action, but I would file a writ now that I know that there's this process.
The writ would be on behalf of?
I think I would file it on behalf of myself because I am the person being harmed. And the problem I
could... Your client isn't the one being harmed?
The client is also being harmed, but my concern would be, Your Honor, that this is a situation that is capable of repetition and which will evade review. And that is one reason to think about class action procedure. The Secretary could moot my writ by simply giving me the rating decision in its final form. And then we completely lose out on one stage in the process of reviewing the draft. So I'm worried that by filing something just in the veteran's name, it doesn't really solve the problem. I'm going to have to constantly file in the veteran's name. So that would be my response, Your Honor, to that.
Because you would be afraid that the VA would short-circuit and give you access, and then as opposed to risking a presidential decision that might be the outcome of a writ.
Exactly, Your Honor. So I don't want to take up more time than the court wants to hear, but I did want to highlight in our briefing, we tried to focus a little bit on the applicable legal analysis here, because the Secretary's brief talks about Fifth Amendment due process, which may be in play. But in our review of it, on behalf of the clinical directors, what we saw is really a what deference does the agency get question, sort of the Chevron hour analysis. And in that regard, I really want to highlight 38 CFR 3.103, which does provide that, as I said, veterans can pick their representative. That representative is entitled to participate at every stage. And importantly, the regulation in subsection B provides that the veteran and the rep are entitled to notice of any decision. Of any decision. That's broad language. And for the adjudication manual to call it a completed rating decision, that sounds like any decision to me that the regulation contemplates we should be notified of.
Would you be, what would your thoughts be if the VA said, well, we're not going to even let VSO see the decision?
My thoughts, Your Honor, would be that would be very unfortunate when our veterans face something like we see in Exhibit B. We need to do everything possible to correct errors as soon as possible.
In other words, Judge Peach's question may raise an additional issue, maybe even of constitutional dimension, but we don't have to reach that in this case, do we?
No, Your Honor.
Because this is strictly a disparity in treatment
exactly. Between
lawyers and VSOs. Let me ask you this. Are you familiar with something called Decision Ready Claims, September 2017, from the Department of Veterans Affairs, which Decision Ready Claims program gets a decision on your, I'm quoting from it now, within 30 days by working with an accredited veterans service organization, and then not all veterans service organizations are accredited, only certain ones, and there's no mention of lawyers.
Right.
What's your view of this?
I'm disappointed. I just had a conversation with a client who asked me, let's do this. And it's like, yes, let's do this. And I read it, and I had to report to the client, I'm sorry, I can't help you with this. This is a client that we have spent 2 years helping. And I can't take advantage of a new program because I'm an attorney. My state bar lets me hold my client's money in trust. I know the Social Security numbers of my clients, my veterans, their kids. I know when we were divorced. I know all of these details. I know all their medical problems. But somehow I can't be trusted to look at a completed rating decision.
And by the way, was this Decision Ready Claims program adopted in accordance with the Administrative Procedure Act? Is there a regulation on this?
Your Honor, I don't think so. I haven't reviewed that, but I haven't seen that.
And it directs people to go to a website entitled benefits.va.gov/compensation/drc.asp. That doesn't include all veteran service organizations, does it? Only the ones selected by VA.
That's my understanding.
And that's September 2017.
That just happened. Just like the recent change to the manual that happened in July that the Petitioner's Council alluded to, all of a sudden we're not just talking about clerical errors in completed rating decisions. The manual was expanded to allow significant discussion. Man, would I love to engage in a cordial, professional, significant discussion with an adjudicator before the rating decision was promulgated. That would be a huge benefit to our clients. And that is the benefit that we seek here. And under our AUER, for students who may be listening, deference, just because you're entitled to deference doesn't mean the agency wins. If the agency's judgment is not fair and considered, then the court does not have to defer to the agency. And we respectfully submit it is not fair and considered here. Attorneys are advocates, no doubt about it. We're trained to be advocates. We're trained to make a record. But VSOs are advocates, too. If you look at the mission statement, and we highlighted in our brief, for all of the major veterans organizations, they are advocates. That's why they exist, to advocate. So that rationale fails.
But one final point, if I may, Chief.
Sure.
If we were to issue a panel decision as opposed to certify this as a class or an aggregate case, the VA could then decide Mr. Rosinski's case, pick him off, allow him. Where does that decision end up in terms of the broader world, wider world outside? Clinics like yourself, lawyers who practice? I mean, where are they going to find out about it? There's no obligation for the VA to publish this panel decision for all the world to see and say, we're going to follow this in every case, is there?
Not that I'm aware of. It's the capable of repetition but evading review problem that I think underscores the need for aggregate treatment here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, I do have another question.
Sure.
Is there, in your view, then, no longer a real distinction between VSOs and attorneys for the purposes of having the privilege of reviewing a draft rating decision?
I don't think there's a rational distinction to be made. We are all there to help the veteran.
So historical distinction is not persuasive to you?
Well, I think the history is only in that VA only provided access to VSOs. Historically, attorneys have helped veterans for a long time, probably since the Civil War. They just couldn't charge for it.
Right. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hello again, Mark Vichich for the Secretary. For this court to have jurisdiction, the petitioner must present a question of fact or law necessary to a decision under a law affecting the provision of benefits. He cited numerous statutes, but none of them address this particular procedure. There's no question that he has raised that could be addressed under any of these particular laws. And that is why we're asking this court to dismiss this petition. Chief Judge Davis mentioned 5701 in the previous argument, which gives the Secretary authority to allow VSOs to review certain internal documents. There's nothing in that statute. There's no language that's at issue here. There's nothing in the statute that raises any questions before this court. And the same is true as 5104, which requires the Secretary to provide notice of decisions in veterans benefits cases. Those decisions, as this court held in Sellers, are final and binding decisions. And the documents that the petitioner seeks to see here are, by definition, neither final nor binding on the agency. So that's why we're asking this court to dismiss this case for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. The second jurisdictional question is the standing issue. To have standing, the petitioner must demonstrate that he has been, has a legally protected interest, that he has suffered a concrete and particularized injury that is actual or imminent. Hypothetical injuries do not satisfy this requirement. He has speculated that maybe his law practice might be harmed, that some of his clients may be harmed, but he doesn't identify specific instances, allegations of specific instances that would support his standing theory. So that's why we're asking this court to dismiss this case as well. I just want to address some points that were made in the previous argument about correcting errors in regional office decisions and how long it takes. I wanted to make two points on that issue. First, as Chief Judge Davis mentioned, the M21 does contain a what's called a reconsideration procedure, and that's at M21-1, Part 3, Subpart 2, Chapter 2, Section F, which does contemplate fixing errors outside of the notice of disagreement process. And the second point on that issue I wanted to make is 7105D1, which requires the Secretary to provide a statement of the case upon receiving a notice of disagreement, but that statute specifically gives the Secretary the authority to resolve appeals without providing a statement of the case. And if I could direct the Court's attention to page 26 of our appendix, this was a document that the amici referred to. I just want to just identify some numbers to put this in perspective. In fiscal year 2014, the Veterans Benefits Administration received 137,766 notices of disagreement. In contrast, in the same period, the Veterans Benefits Administration received only 47,065 formal appeals. That means there's a much smaller number of cases that are actually going to pass the SOC process to the substantive appeal process. This indicates that many appeals are, in fact, being resolved way early in the process without having to wait the years for a board decision.
Counsel, do you have any figures on requests by VSOs to review draft rating decisions during that same time period?
I do not, Your Honor. I have, no. The closest data I could find, and I want to make sure I'm getting it right, what happens is when these decisions, they're called completed rating decisions, they go into VBMS, the VSO is given a notice that they have 48 hours to review it. When they click on it and actually open that document, that is tracked. And in fiscal year 2016, it was approximately 36% of the time VSOs were looking at that. Now, that doesn't track whether they did anything. Maybe they looked at it and did nothing. Maybe they said, oh, there's an error here. The VBA does not have that data, but approximately 36%. Of VSOs are using this feature at least to look.
So the percentage is a function of the VSOs who are using it. Is that correct?
That number indicates that percentage of VSOs are utilizing the ability to open that document. To talk about the third point, the Chief Judge laid out four points to address. The Secretary wants to address, must VA provide access in the same manner as it does attorneys? The appropriate question the Secretary submits is to look at whether the Secretary is doing everything he has required by law. If the Secretary said he is only going to provide assistance and medical opinions for veterans represented by VSOs but not attorneys, that would be unlawful. If he was going to restrict the rights to a hearing to certain types of representatives, that would be unlawful. But the point is that no statute or regulation requires the Secretary to provide this access to anybody. So there's no, there's nothing about this policy that requires access to a draft decision to have, for example, full appellate rights. So that's what we think, to put
okay,
it in the
Counselor, we got that, obviously, but you heard the tenor of the questions that were being raised by the bench regarding why treat attorneys differently, and really that gets to the heart of the matter, doesn't it? The historical connections to the VSOs are legion, but is that a viable current reason to treat attorneys differently? Can you address that?
Well, the two points we can make on that. First is that we're making an apples-to-oranges comparison. In legal terms, it's the groups are not similarly situated. So when we compare, can VA treat attorneys this way and non-attorneys that way, it's not a useful comparison just because they are different in so many ways. But even if we were to put these three categories of representatives, and Congress has created three categories, agents, attorneys, and organizations, even if we compare them together, the Secretary simply needs a rational basis for doing one, what it does for one and for the other.
And that's the question. What's the rational basis?
The rational basis is that if the Secretary were to extend this to attorneys, he would find it very difficult to not have to extend this to all claimants. And it's administratively infeasible to extend this to, for example, pro se claimants. There would be no way that it could survive, certainly not as a 48-hour review policy. The process would probably go away if the Secretary were to have to extend this to all claimants, even if they're not represented.
Well, we don't know how many claimants would take advantage of it. I mean, you just said that only 36% of the VSOs take advantage of this. So it might be that only 36% of the claimants take advantage of this. Is that too large of a percentage for the system to handle?
That would be, Your Honor. It would be administratively difficult, just the logistics of providing this access, whether we would have to provide PIV badges to every pro se veteran and give them access to VBMS, whether we would have to mail them a decision and give them time to respond. And if that's how we're doing this, then 48 hours would not be enough time.
Why do you even have that process?
The process has...
Why don't you just eliminate it?
As we pointed out in our brief, it's been in existence for many decades, at least six decades. I was able to trace it back to at least the 1950s. It's there. It does provide an extra level of review. It's similar to an in-house quality review process. Now, the Veterans Benefits Administration in 2012 introduced a much more extensive in-house quality review process. So whether this having the VSOs provide this extra step is making a difference is it's not entirely clear that that's the case. But it is there, it has existed, and there's a reluctance to get rid of this extra procedural step, even if it's the benefits are
it doesn't do any good. I mean, historically, having a process is an explanation, but I guess the real question is, does it do any good? And if it does, then obviously there's reason to keep it, but if it doesn't, why do so?
The data that I've reviewed does not confirm whether this particular procedure itself makes any difference. What I do have are percentages of cases that are sent back based on representation. And what I mean by sent back is when it gets to that completed, the decision gets put into VBMS, it's called a completed decision. At that point, it goes through a further in-house quality review process before it's called pending authorization is the fourth step of this four-step process. The difference between in VSOs, just for the fiscal year 2016, in VSO cases, 10.4% were sent back because of some detected error. That does not explain who detected the error or whether it was outcome determinative. All it means is that 10.4% of cases where VSOs were represented went back for some sort of revision.
Sent back from?
It was before it gets promulgated and becomes a final appealable decision.
Okay.
It goes sent back for further
for
review.
Correction.
A correction. And again, that doesn't mean that it went from a denial to a grant. It just means there was some sort of error. For attorney represented veterans, it's 11.3%, which is not a huge difference, but it's actually a small number of attorney cases are being sent back, a larger number are being sent back compared to VSO representatives.
So we're still talking about the draft decision.
Draft decisions,
well,
correct.
What is this thing about 11% of those attorney things? I thought attorneys couldn't get it.
Exactly, and that indicates that this our internal process is catching these. This data doesn't show why, who caught the error, whether it's a VSO, whether it's our internal process. But if VSOs were catching errors at a much higher rate than we were, we would expect the VSO decisions to be going back at a much higher rate. And they're actually going back at it's very similar, 10.4 versus 11.3%, but it's actually a slightly smaller rate.
It appears that your manual was changed slightly, or at least a couple of words were changed, but maybe the effect wasn't slight, that it says now that the purpose of the VSO review, this is that manual provision that we're talking about today, the purpose of the VSO review is to identify any clear errors or matters of clarification that require, and then what was added, significant discussion and or correction prior to promulgation. So now this brings in this concept of significant discussion, which wasn't in the prior the manual, which you changed just recently.
Correct. The manual provisions going all the way back from the 50s version that we cited to the 70s versions to the one that was in effect when this petition was filed, they all contemplate modification of decisions. The substance of this procedure has always been a clerical error that doesn't really make a difference, could be fixed just to clarify, make the decision clearer to read. It could be fixing typographical errors, or it could be changing important dates of service that result in a complete grant of benefits. So,
but the significant discussion seems to be robbing those other people who don't have access to the draft decision of the opportunity for significant discussion.
The manual in effect before that date, the substance hasn't changed. Those discussions, whether we call them significant or not, have always been able to occur. So the change in the language in the manual doesn't change how the policy actually works. The VSOs have always had the opportunity to point out errors, identify mistakes, which could be, we can call those significant discussions. So there's no meaningful change other than just to clarify how the procedure works.
Okay. Mr. Vichich, I need some clarification from you on these percentages. Do I understand that 10.4% of draft rating decisions are sent back for further correction? And these are rating decisions that VSOs have had the opportunity to review?
They are all VSO, all cases where VSO is the representative. That doesn't count. So, yes, the opportunity to review. Whether they reviewed it, we don't know. Okay. The VBA doesn't.
But
does
the key
not
is that they're all cases where VSOs were representatives.
Correct.
And the percentage with respect to attorneys would be cases where all attorneys were represented, but not
did not have
enough. There was no opportunity to review draft rating decisions. This is just cases where they're represented and they're sent back for some correction as well.
Correct, but I want to clarify one point here. The procedure in the manual does not contemplate that an attorney will have the ability to identify errors. The procedure itself does not extend.
Final decision.
Correct, but I want to make this clear. This may not have been clear from our pleadings. Any person who has VBMS access, even if it's an attorney, can see these draft decisions, and that's not something that I understood. And if that was not clear in our pleadings, I apologize for that. As the amici pointed out, an attorney does seemingly have this access to these draft decisions. Every attorney who has VBMS access, and many who represent veterans do, can see these draft decisions. Once they're put in VBMS, they're available to see. The difference is that VSOs and only VSOs are given this notice with this 48-hour clock that says you have 48 hours if you see anything that that if we've made a mistake, please let us know. And second, if an attorney were to see one of these draft decisions and say, I have a correction to make, then that we would not modify the decision in that manner, but we could do it under the reconsideration provisions under the M21 or after filing of a notice of disagreement. And if it's a clear error, it would be corrected long before a statement of the case would need to be.
What's the harm to the department in allowing a lawyer to see it on the same basis as the VSO if the purpose is to correct an obvious or maybe not so obvious error in this preliminary determination, apart from the fact that you've always done it this way, at least for six decades?
The harm, Your Honor, or at least the concern, is that we would find it really difficult to justify not extending this to unrepresented veterans. And
take your March of Horribles example, and you have to extend it to everybody, a veteran, a VSO, and a veteran's lawyer. What's the problem? It's an electronic system, isn't it? Or the veteran walks into the regional office and looks at the draft form, or the lawyer does. Either way, what's the problem for the VA?
Well, one...
Why can't you handle that?
Well, one potential concern, Your Honor, is from the court seller's decision, where if a claimant has actual notice of a decision, then it becomes final and binding as a matter of law. And that's one of the concerns, in addition to the administrative infeasibility of granting, of trying to give these draft decisions in a reasonable review period to hundreds of thousands of veterans. It's if a veteran sees a decision, that a document that is supposed to be internal draft, it then, under this court's seller's decision, VA is not allowed to modify it. We cannot let unrepresented veterans see these and then make modifications to it. Because the court held in Sellers that actual receipt of a document is notice of the document, and that's notice of a decision within 5104A. So even if the secretary says, hey, these are just drafts, they convert from a legal perspective into a final and appealable decision. So that's why, as we argued in our brief, that the system, this procedure simply doesn't work if we were extended to unrepresented claimants.
So I heard earlier from the clinicians that at least one clinician had access to the draft decision. Was that because they have access to the draft decision, but they can't do the 48, they don't have this?
That's correct. That means this attorney had access to VBMS, and they were able to see the what we would call it a completed rating decision. Now, there was a note in there in one of the attachments to the briefs that indicated that VSO review does apply to attorneys, and if that means that somebody in the regional office thought that attorneys do have the ability to suggest changes and point out mistakes for correction, that's incorrect. That would the policy is... mentioned it in the adjudication manual, specifically says only veteran service organizations. So it does appear that maybe somebody at the regional office mistakenly thought that this 48-hour review extended to attorneys, and that's incorrect.
What about this new decision-ready claims procedure?
Aren't
you creating yet another class of favored litigant?
Judge
for the agency?
Judge Greenberg, I apologize. I'm not prepared to discuss that matter. I hadn't heard about it until this morning.
You hadn't heard about it until I raised it.
That's correct.
Right.
Yes. And finally, the Secretary would like to discuss the motion for aggregate action.
Yeah, before you go there,
yes.
Counsel, have you provided Mr. Rozinski with a final appealable decision?
No, and the reason we have... not done so is because our position is that this is not a decision that can be appealed to the board because there's no jurisdiction. There's no question of law or fact, necessary decision under law that affects the provision of benefits. So we couldn't provide him a decision that he could appeal to the board when our position is that this is not a matter that could be appealed to the board.
Are you familiar with the Chisholm case?
I am familiar.
Didn't you make the same argument there?
I did. And
what happened?
Well,
just curious.
I recall, Chief Judge Davis, you were on the panel.
Right.
And and I argued for the respondent. The difference between that case and this one is that 14.629 addressed access to records for representatives, including support staff.
That was under 5904.
And that regulation was promulgated pursuant to a statute. And here we don't have anything that links us to a statute affecting the provision of benefits. So that's how we just don't get there.
Well,
But the Fed Circuit said that is a law, and I think Mr. Rosinski applied that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's what distinguishes this case from Chisholm.
Give him jurisdiction, at least subject matter jurisdiction.
And that was what the court held in Chisholm, because the question presented in that case was ultimately related to 5904. But we don't have any question like that here.
Access to records.
We're not denying access, but 14.629 doesn't discuss this particular issue, this access to internal records. 14.629 dealt with access to the actual documents used to adjudicate a claim. So we're not denying access to any evidence that the regional office reviewed to render a decision. We're not denying access or notice of a decision. We're just limiting to a particular group who can see these decisions before they become a final and appealable decision. And that's the distinction we're making with this case in Chisholm, Your Honor. And I just want to, the Secretary would like to move on to the aggregate action motion. As we argued in our pleadings, we're asking this court to dismiss or in the alternative to deny the motion. Our basis for dismissal is primarily because this is a major procedural change, and this court has in the past always approached these issues by studying it, looking at the rule, taking advisement under the Rules Advisory Committee, and determining the appropriate course of action. And there are two reasons the Secretary just wants to point out here why that approach would be wise in this case. The first has to do with this court's unique subject matter jurisdiction. It's narrow, and it's limited to reviewing final decisions of the board. And that is why, for example, if Veteran A has a claim pending here, Veteran B has a claim pending below, certifying a class to include both Veteran A and Veteran B raises serious questions as to how Veteran B can get into this court without a final board decision. And that's just something that the Secretary is asking this court to consider and suggesting that doing so based on the Rules Advisory Committee as opposed to in case law would be the appropriate approach. The same point we can make with exhaustion of administrative remedies. One of the amici cited a Supreme Court case, United States versus Bowen, about Social Security class action lawsuit, where the Supreme Court said that it was okay to waive certain administrative remedies in that case to certify a class of some of those claimants. The difference between the administrative remedies here and the administrative remedies at issue there is that here getting a board decision is jurisdictional. If the court were to waive administrative remedies, it would be running into serious problems with 7252A. And the second point the Secretary wants to make on the aggregate action issue is this court's limited ability to make factual findings, or I should say inability to make factual findings in the first instance. The amici cite a number of other procedures in other Article I tribunals, such as the tax court, the Court of Federal Claims, the Office of Special Masters within the Court of Federal Claims, bankruptcy courts, and so on. The difference is in each of those tribunals, they have authority to hold bench trials, to conduct discovery, to review evidence in the first instance. This court, on the other hand, does not have the authority to engage in that sort of fact-finding. So if this court were to, looking at how it should approach this issue, the Secretary is just asking this court to be mindful of the distinctions between this court and those other Article I courts.
Well, the Supreme Court had no difficulty in likening this court to an Article III court in reviewing an administrative agency in Henderson. And there, we were dealing with a statutory command, shall file a notice of appeal within 120 days. The Supreme Court had no difficulty in saying that that was not jurisdictional. That was an important procedural rule, but not jurisdictional.
That's correct.
Why isn't this precisely the same thing we're dealing with, or do you not agree? Does the Secretary disagree that this is an important property right given by Congress, the right to a correct rating under the system by the VA?
We agree with that point, and I think your point...
Well, then don't we have a matter of constitutional dimension? Are not certain classes of veterans represented by lawyers who seek access to this information denied this important property right without due process of law? You haven't even adopted a regulation justifying the distinction between lawyers and VSOs. You haven't even adopted a regulation making a distinction between this favored class of VSO that I mentioned to you, this whatever this process is in September 2017, and all the other VSOs. You haven't even adopted a regulation making a distinction between a veteran and a veteran's representative, VSO or lawyer. So why shouldn't we be skeptical as a matter of constitutional dimension, if nothing else, as to this practice?
The Secretary is not willing to concede any jurisdictional points. I guess I understand your concerns, Judge Greenberg, but again, we still have 7252A, and just to distinguish Henderson, that important procedural rule is similar to the rule at issue in the case of the U.S. versus Bowen, or it might have been Bowen versus U.S., I apologize if I'm getting it wrong, with the Social Security claimants. There was the law in that case said the claimants must file their claim with the district court within, I think it was 60 days. That, the Supreme Court held, was not jurisdictional, and that's how the court could waive those administrative remedies. 7252A, and that's the notice of appeal at issue in Henderson is more similar to that instance, that situation. 7258, on the other hand, is jurisdictional. And that's, to get into the courthouse door, this court must have jurisdiction over the claim, and regardless of any constitutional issues.
Go ahead.
Let me just go back in time. Mr. Rosinski, how I think maybe what leads me to believe we got here is that Mr. Rosinski, since about January of 2014, has been consistently requesting on a formal basis, that is through letters, access. He wrote a letter to the Columbia Regional Office in January of 2014. Then he wrote again to the regional office in March of 2014. He wrote to the Honorable Lee Bradley in 2015. He wrote to the Honorable Shulkin in February of 2017. What does the VA do with these letters? It just seems like they're dissing.
I understand your concern. It's unfortunate that he had to ask over a period of years. The only explanation I can offer, at least especially for the initial request, is that this is probably not something that has been asked before, or it's not asked frequently.
It could not have, especially from, let's say, the general counsel, one attorney to another, an acknowledgement, I've got your letter, I am referring it to the appropriate department for answering. Thank you for your interest.
The Secretary does understand the concerns of having somebody have to ask repeatedly.
Well, wouldn't that be eliminated if we decided to aggregate this matter and for all the world to see? Wouldn't it be something you should be ordered to put on your website? Just as a hypothetical matter, put on your website. Lawyers have a right to see it the way VSOs have a right to see it. Wouldn't that be a better, more efficient way of helping veterans, assisting veterans?
No, Your Honor. A panel decision would provide the same relief to petitioner.
Well, let me ask you that. Recently, this court decided in Staub. You familiar with that opinion?
It's
a panel decision a year ago. The VA made at least two attempts to stay the precedential effect of that panel decision denied on the basis that it would cost too much money to implement it. While it was pending at the Federal Circuit, the VA withdrew its appeal, the appeal which said that it was wrongly decided by this court. Recently, the Secretary testified that he was withdrawing that appeal, and that has been done. Are you familiar with that?
I am familiar with the
And do you know how many people were subject to the precedential decision of this court? 370,000 is what the Secretary told the Senate in June. How many of those, pursuant to this a panel opinion, have been paid?
I do not know.
Any?
I do not know.
Why should we trust that the VA will take a panel decision as opposed to an aggregate decision and an order in a class action and pay a deserving veteran? Why should we have any confidence that it will do so?
The Secretary has, in the past, provided relief to multiple claimants based on single panel decisions. We pointed out one case in our brief. There would be no justification for the Secretary treating a panel decision with respect to one party different than one in which is a class certification. The Secretary could not treat those differently. It would not make a difference. And that is why, for example, the Third Circuit case we cited in our brief, the Gale versus Monmouth County, that provides an excellent distinction between the concerns that some district courts have when litigating against the government versus our case. Courts are routinely reluctant to grant class actions when government, allegedly unlawful government conduct is involved, because one decision will take care of the issue for everybody. The only times the courts are careful of that, if there's some sort of if the government in its discretion can enforce the judgment in one circuit but not another. And that was the concern at issue in that case. But as this court has been clear in numerous decisions, its panel decisions apply to the entire agency. Every regional office in the country, the Secretary cannot pick and choose which panel decisions to follow. So calling it a class action or calling it a panel decision will have the same legal effect.
Mr. Vichich, you opened your argument with indicating that comparing attorneys and VSOs were like apples and oranges. I really would like to hear why VSOs have this privilege and attorneys do not, particularly in light of the VGARA being passed in 1988 that has certainly begun to open up this whole process to attorneys. Is that distinction really continued? Is it viable as of 1988, and should it continue?
Yes, and here's why. The policy was originally implemented many, many years ago in a different time, and that's true. Congress has, in two instances, opened the door to attorneys, first in 1988 and then again in 2006 by permitting attorneys to charge fees earlier in the process. That is,
and the current legislation even opens it a little bit further. Appeals Reform Act.
No, sorry.
The Appeals Modernization Act opens it even further.
Yes.
That was just passed.
Yes, correct. As in effect today, only approximately 88% to 90% of cases do not result in a notice of disagreement. The vast majority of these cases are going to get resolved before a veteran is even allowed to hire an attorney. Congress did not want to change how it existed for the vast majority of claimants. And in our case, that means this informal procedure of letting the VSO take a look at a decision as an extra level of quality review. And again, VA changed its in-house quality review procedure in 2012, so whether this particular procedure to this day makes a big difference is subject to debate. But the Secretary is unwilling or skeptical about his ability to extend this to attorneys without having to extend this to all claimants, in which case it wouldn't survive. It would have to the procedure could not exist in that situation. It only exists with this very specific type of...
Yeah, but that's your argument. You don't have any empirical evidence to suggest that the system would collapse if you extended it to attorneys or to everybody, do you?
No, we don't know what happened.
What does the chairman of the Board of Veterans Appeals annual report for 2016 show? Is that out yet? That's a report required by Congress to be submitted annually. Has 2016 been published?
I'm pretty sure it was this spring. Yes.
What does it show?
It shows all the data, how many appeals were filed, how many cases were remanded, how many were granted. It has data as to different, it has a lot of different data.
Does it have any data along the lines I just suggested?
No, that wouldn't include, no. This is a VBA policy. The board, it wouldn't be something that would be included in a board annual report.
Thank you.
This question has to do with standing, because you allege Mr. Rosinski doesn't have standing. How would somebody get standing to pursue this? How would it be a veteran who'd have to do it?
I think your question proves the Secretary's point. It's difficult to fathom how somebody could be injured by this, or at least be able to demonstrate it with concrete, particularized facts.
But if a veteran went in and asked for access, I mean, is it possible that veteran could pursue it then?
It's possible, but it's difficult for me to articulate how that could result in an injury. And that's the important. We're here because petitioner is claiming that he has been injured by this policy, but it's difficult to tell how he or any claimant could actually be harmed by this, considering that there are many ways to rectify any errors that might not have been corrected by the pre-decision review policy. It's the Secretary is unable to identify how somebody could prove standing in this type of issue, in this type of case. Thank you, Your Honors. That completes the Secretary's case.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. McLeod, your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, I'd like to address a few of the points I heard from the Secretary. For starters, I'd like to point out that this case is not about equal protection, constitutional equal protection. This is about equal access and equal process, which is we're talking about a fundamentally fair adjudication process in all claims. I also want to point out that the Secretary conceded that there's no decision to appeal here. So there's no note that regarding some of the discussions earlier, as he's conceded there's no decision to appeal, the only alternative is us to be here before you today seeking a writ, which all the more makes the writ appropriate. I would like to touch briefly on...
Let me just go back to that decision. Because there's no decision, you said that he can appeal. That's why we're here, why you're here. Does he want a decision from the...
No, Your Honor, if I misspoke, what I meant to point out was that the Secretary conceded that there was no decision.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood. I thought that there was no decision with respect to his, Mr. Vosinski's request.
If I misspoke, glad you pointed it out. But some of the points that brought up about access to VBMS, I would point out that Mr. Rosinski has been unable to get on VBMS for the last 10 days. And when he has called to try to get the situation rectified, he was 88th in line on the helpline. So the fact that there may be a short period of time where someone would have access to VBMS, there's also other circumstances involved which would still prevent that. The Secretary addressed the level of harm. This is not a hypothetical situation. Mr. Rosinski is a practicing attorney. He is prosecuting, presenting, preparing claims on behalf of his clients. He could go home tomorrow and seek access on 40 different claims and have to file 40 different petitions the next week. So this, to say that...
Isn't that hypothetical?
Your Honor, I would say it would be hypothetical if somebody said, I'm going to start representing veterans at some point, and then I'm going to, when I do, then this is going to affect me. But this is something that affects Mr. Rosinski right now, today. And it, for every other claim that both he and other attorneys have, it affects them today. It appears from some of the statistics we heard today that the policy at issue here may be applied differently in different regional offices, which I think goes to the point that that makes an aggregate action all the more appropriate, because a presidential decision applied different ways in different regional offices doesn't solve the problem, whereas a uniform, consistent outcome through an aggregate order gives veterans, their attorneys, the best opportunity to ensure a consistent and fair result across the board.
Could you address Chisholm? Chisholm, you believe, is on point for your client? That Chisholm gives you jurisdiction?
Well, the All Writs Act, certainly. Okay. Cited in Chisholm.
Right. That's how we got to Chisholm, under an All Writs Act. That's how Chisholm came to this court.
Right. Yes, Your Honor. Okay.
So, what is it that your client wants? Does he want a decision from somebody in VA so that he could bring the come to this court on an appeal of that decision, or does he want access?
My client is seeking access, Your Honor.
But then in Chisholm, the court ordered that the secretary issue a decision on Mr. Chisholm's request, and then that decision provided the basis for coming to this court if that became necessary.
If I understand your question, Your Honor, I think to the Secretary's point earlier, there's no decision here to appeal anyway.
So should we order the Secretary to issue a decision?
Your Honor, I think you should order the Secretary.
A decision on Mr. Rosinski, not a decision on, I mean, we're talking a decision for Mr. Rosinski. Yes, yes.
Well, I said decision, but yeah. We would ask the court to order that Mr. Rosinski be granted equal access on behalf of himself and other similarly situated attorneys. And we would ask this court to order the Secretary to grant equal process for his clients and other situated claimants who are represented by attorneys. And
you'd also ask us to construct or fashion an order making it clear to all the world what we have decided.
Yes, Your Honor, in an aggregate fashion that makes it crystal clear to all regional offices and the entire department.
So considering all the information in the file regarding all of Mr. Rosinski's requests throughout the years, would it not be reasonable for this court to order the Secretary to give Mr. Rosinski a decision on his request? And thereby at least more easily get jurisdiction to come to this court if it was adverse to him, and then we'd have an adverse finding that Mr. Rosinski could present to this court?
If I'm understanding your question correctly, Your Honor, yes, we would want this court to order access for Mr. Rosinski.
But you don't think it's necessary for you to prevail, do you, for us to issue such an order? Keep this matter going. You're here to resolve the fundamental dispute.
Yes,
lawyers don't have access, VSOs do.
Yes,
and you want us to decide that now.
Yes, Your Honor.
On an aggregate basis.
Yes, Your Honor. If there are no other questions, I thank the court for their time.
Okay. Thank you. I'd like to also again compliment both counsel for the quality of their briefs and the oral argument. All counsel, I should say. The case is submitted for consideration. The court will now come down and greet counsel.
All rise. The court will be recessed for a 15-minute period. If you don't need to clear the court, or we do need to have the attorneys in the room.